Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 174, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be sitting down with former British ambassador to Israel and Saudi Arabia, Sherrod Cooper Coles, to hear how a smile and sense of humour are key to healthy foreign relations.
We'll also be talking about the aftermath of Sri Lanka's civil war and why it should still be making headlines 3 years after a supposed peace agreement was made.
And we'll be meeting Christiana Bakker, the former face of MTV, who changed her lifestyle by embracing Islam.
That's all to come. Plus, of course, we'll look ahead to the next week's big stories. And yes, don't you worry, there'll also be some music too. All right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. We have lots of orange juice. There's a very good selection of bagels and a couple of flat whites. It's all you need, really, for a Sunday, isn't it, Tom?
Everything. I'm in a fine fettle then this morning.
You really are, and you've already sort of looked through the Sunday papers. You've sort of put your feet up.
Had a breath. I feel nicely rested.
Yes, perfect timing for us to start the Monocle Weekly. It's been quite a nice week here, hasn't it, at Midori House? Quite quiet in terms of certain personalities, you know, out of the building.
Well, it always helps when Rob's far away.
And he's about as far away as it's possible to go. I think the only reason Andrew agreed to send him on this trip was so he could say, yeah, I've sent Rob to Siberia.
I mean, it literally helps.
Yeah, that is actually where he is. Rob is currently rather cold in Siberia. I think Tyler is somewhere on holiday in Japan and Sophie's in Cambridge.
All points of the globe covered, as usual on Monocle. It's the way it always is. And it's been a busy week for us. We've been putting together our special election programmes from the United States. You're shortly about to jet off to the US yourself.
I wasn't supposed to be here. I should have been in America by now. But sadly, we got delayed, understandably delayed, by Superstorm Sandy, which kept us grounded here in London. So we've been doing a sort of a two-hander between London and New York, with me in London and Aisha at our studios in New York for our Midori House specials. But we'll be doing them all from New York from tomorrow onwards.
Very successful. Can I say that, Steve? They've been a pleasure to listen to.
Oh, you can say that, yeah.
I like to try and, you know, butter you up every now and again.
Yeah, normally when you're asking me to do something. As I said, we'll be in New York from tomorrow for our election specials. The US election, though, isn't the only thing that's happening next week. Should we ask Adrian Craddock, who I think has borrowed your crystal ball to give it a little bit of shine.
He's going to be gazing into it right now.
Okay, let's ask Adrian what's in his balls. Now, one of the problems with over-promoting Tom Edwards to the position of Monocle Weekly co-host is that it's meant we've had to similarly over-promote Adrian Craddock to the role of Monocle Weekly whipping boy.
A bit strong. How's everyone going?
We're in a fine mood. I have a feeling that this pleasant atmosphere might be about to take a turn for the worst.
No. Go on, let's keep things relatively serious and sensible for at least a moment.
Well, as you say, I've borrowed Tom Edwards's crystal ball. I've seen some interesting things are going to happen this week. Actually, one thing that caught my eye is actually happening today. It'd be happening right now, actually. It's the election of the new Coptic Church, the Egyptian Coptic Church Pope. And I mean, we've been so caught up in obviously the big election that's happening at the moment that
we've missed this one out.
This one's been overlooked, which I feel is quite unfair. And it's got quite an interesting kind of the way they do things is quite interesting. So they have all these candidates. They narrow it down to 5 candidates through internal voting. And then those candidates are narrowed down to 3. So they've done quite a lot of campaigning, quite a lot of political manoeuvring. And then how do you think they get the final winner?
I like to think it's a very, you know, cerebral process, maybe a series of in-depth interviews.
I hope it's a winner stays on duel.
The names of the final 3 are put into a very ceremonial box.
Does God decide?
In a way, through the form of a blindfolded child, who then comes up to this box in a ceremony and then picks the name out of the winner.
And that's the new Coptic pontiff chosen.
Exactly.
I think that's how we should hire staff. We've got an option between two people. then you know, that's how we could do it. Okay, so aside from the choosing the new pontiff for the Coptic Church in Egypt, what else do we have to look forward to this week?
Well, let's talk a little bit about the big event on Tuesday. I'm not talking about the election, actually. I'm talking about Melbourne Cup in Australia. So you're looking at me quite blank face now, but
I'm not. I'm a big fan of racing.
It's a horse race. It's quite big. Don't you get a day off?
This is not just a horse race. This is really one of those things where the whole of Australia kind of stands still for the duration of this race. But the funny thing, it's supposed to be a corker, by the way. It's supposed to be an absolute cracker. Some are kind of saying it has the potential, just through the makeup of the horses in the race, it could be one of the greats.
Yeah, no, Hugo is going to be there for the Melbourne Cup. He's the guest of honour.
Up another rung on the boozometer.
Yeah, yeah. And it's one of those real races where everyone kind of dresses up and it's a real event. I wonder kind of what fascinator Hugo will be. Kind of strolling in with, you know, we can't look ahead for the next week without mentioning the obvious. So obviously on Tuesday, November 6th, that's when the big vote will happen. And I found it interesting. I had a look at kind of...
Hang on, are you actually talking about the US election now?
I've okay. kind of gestured right. around it, but this is the big one. So Romney v. Obama, it's going down on Tuesday. So the thing that I found interesting is I looked at the big celebrations that they're both having, or potential celebrations, on Tuesday evening. And the thing that kind of struck me is Obama has moved his election night event inside. Obviously, you know, with the last election, there was that very iconic footage outdoors in Grant Park giving that extremely famous speech. Now he kind of disappointingly, it's at the McCormick Place Convention Centre. So that kind of... I don't know.
It's not quite as evocative, is it?
I know. You don't see the same image of, you know, the screaming crowd and the kind of emotion within quite a...
Jesse Jackson crying.
Yeah. You've got to manage expectations, I guess. You know, we're in this time of austerity. Some people claim that been a little disappointed by his first term efforts. If he did win, perhaps he wants to kind of temper those expectations. Maybe that's behind it.
The official line from the White House is security. So, I mean, a smaller venue, it's easier to kind of keep tabs on security. And obviously, Romney will be in Boston, where his headquarters are. But, I mean, a very, very similar kind of surroundings, quite a dry kind of convention center, and I think it will be just interesting that whether the turnout will be as great as in former years. A Gallup poll suggests that it won't be, and that poll was actually done before Hurricane Sandy, and people assume that might have a bit of an effect as well.
Let's leave that there. Adrian, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Monocle Weekly.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're back with the Monocle Weekly. Our first guest has been watching the diplomatic world, indeed has been part of the diplomatic world for more than 30 years, having held ambassadorial positions for the UK in locations as diverse as Israel, Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. Sherrod Cooper-Coles has now written a new book, Ever the Diplomat, Confessions of a Foreign Office Mandarin, and he joins us in the studio now. Your new book, Ever the Diplomat, let me ask a sort of a relatively blunt question to start with. Diplomats are supposed to, on the whole, keep things to themselves. It's what happens behind the doors of an embassy are you know, for yourself, for your ministers, not for necessarily for the rest of us. Did anyone say to you, perhaps you shouldn't really be writing this book?
No, in fact, I was encouraged to write it, and as I say in the introduction, Foreign Office regulations actually encourage the writing of memoirs by diplomats. The whole book was cleared by MI6, by the Cabinet Office, by Buckingham Palace. So I'm afraid there are no great state secrets in it, but there's plenty of amusing stories. And your view of diplomacy, Steve, is a little bit old-fashioned. You know, diplomacy should be open. We have ambassadors tweeting and blogging and on YouTube. You can see me on YouTube as ambassador in Afghanistan. So I think the idea that diplomacy has to be kept secret, that is an activity kept away from the world, I think there's a distinction between that and state secrets and things you're told in confidence. And obviously I've protected those.
Now, you're a diplomat for 3 decades. What sort of changes did you see in the way that diplomacy works? Obviously, you mentioned YouTube and tweeting. You obviously weren't doing that in 1977 when you started out.
No, well, the main change, I think, is that we now have a global foreign office, and embassies abroad are simply outstations of a global network. And as ambassador in Israel or Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or wherever you may be, you're now linked to London by secure real-time communications, both voice and video now. So I found myself as ambassador in Riyadh, ambassador in Kabul, taking part by video conference with meetings with the foreign secretary in London. So the old distinction between policy being made in London and executed by diplomats abroad has gone. And the team on the ground in Lebanon or wherever it may be can make a real contribution to policy in London in a way that just wasn't possible before.
I just wonder, over your career, did you detect a real difference in terms of the kind of disciplines you needed to excel at to be a great diplomat? Did it become more about communications and managing the communications industry that it became, or were the sort of the traditional virtues still the critical ones when it came to doing a great job?
Well, I think there was a shift. I mean, it was partly a shift over time, but it's partly a shift as you become more senior in the diplomatic service. You're more outward facing, as it were, and as an ambassador in 3 different posts, I found myself going on Israel Army Radio or being interviewed on Saudi television or being on the BBC in Kabul. So, no, that certainly changed. And I think ministers became more relaxed about letting ambassadors get out in front of the microphones or cameras or whatever it may be. And I think it's a very, very important part of diplomacy today.
Foreign ministries are often the first ministry in the firing line when it comes to an age of austerity. Very easy to for politicians to say, "Oh, there should be cuts there." There's often no one really takes to the streets to defend what diplomats might be doing abroad. Do you worry when you look now at the way that budgets being cut for foreign ministries all over the world, that there's a danger that less face-to-face diplomacy is really being done where it needs to be done?
No, I don't, because I I think, honestly, there's still a lot of fat in foreign ministries around the world. And actually, you know, the sums involved are so tiny compared with defence budgets and whatever else. Countries need networks of overseas offices. They need people on the ground. But how they use them, there can be a lot of flexibility. And in practice, you know, we don't need a vast embassy in Paris anymore. People can get on the Eurostar. We do need an ambassador. We do need 1 or 2 people who know the local politics, how to operate the local bureaucracy. But frankly, a lot of what foreign ministries do is routine reporting, stuff that is not really absolutely sort of mission critical for government. So I'm not particularly concerned.
And in terms of then the areas of the world which currently, I mean, often it's been the case that for generations they've been the most challenging in terms of being able to do good diplomacy. Do you think there's a special mindset, a special set of skills that are required to be an effective operator there? And do you still think we're, certainly in Britain, creating people who still excel in those areas?
Well, I think, you know, conflict zones, and we've seen plenty of them in recent years, do require a different set of skills from more traditional diplomacy. But I think Britain is actually quite good at developing those skills. And certainly in Kabul, I had a team of diplomats and intelligence officers who I think, and development staff, who I think were really well equipped to the environment. I think there's a danger in all foreign ministries, but perhaps particularly in the British Foreign Ministry and the French Foreign Ministry, of thinking we're more powerful than we really are, and that we need a policy for every separate country of our own. Whereas in reality, the only power in the world that probably can make a difference is the United States. I mean, when I arrived in Kabul, I said to my head of station, the MI6 chief in Afghanistan, I said, of course, my first priority is to form a relationship with President Karzai. And he said, no, it isn't. Your job is to have a relationship with the American ambassador and influence him. That's how you'll really make a difference here. And those are wise words and ones we'd often remember. I had lunch last week with someone who's attended National Security Council meetings under the new coalition government, and she was saying that very often ministers and officials sit round and say we must have a British policy towards Syria or a British policy towards Libya or a British policy. In reality, Britain, the scope for Britain to have a serious independent policy, I mean, we can have words written on a piece of paper, but a serious independent policy is actually rather limited. And we'd be doing everyone a favour if we educated ministers and educated the public that Britain is actually better off working with its European partners and with the Americans than trying to behave as a sort of independent great power.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. In your last book, Cables from Kabul, and also in this book as well, you're very critical of how things have turned out there, what Western policy has been like in Afghanistan and about the war. And yet, when we look politically, both in Britain and the US, there's almost a consensus amongst the sort of the political elite about what should be done in Afghanistan. There's this withdrawal in 2014, and that we shouldn't, you know, and no one deviates from that script. Are you surprised by the fact that there aren't leading politicians and more voices saying, no, we should get out now?
No, I'm not. I mean, I know privately that few, if any, politicians really believe in the war. But rather, as I point out, you know, happened with the Kennedy administration keeping going in Vietnam when they knew the strategy wouldn't work. So too with the Obama administration supporting the surge when people around President Obama and perhaps the president himself knew it wouldn't work. So politicians are striking a balance between acceding to public opinion, and as far as I can tell, no one in Britain really believes in the strategy, because it isn't a strategy, and, you know, letting the armed forces down gently.
But if no one believes in it, if absolutely no one believes in the strategy, and yet absolutely everyone is saying this is our strategy and we do believe in it, there's something odd going on there, isn't there?
There's something very odd going on there, and it's I mean, it's set out in a book I've recently been reading called by Barbara Tuchman called The March of Folly, and it's called Cognitive Dissonance, The Facts on the Ground. Anyone who knows anything about Afghanistan knows that a so-called military strategy of garrisoning parts of the country and then changing over the forces garrisoning it from the 3rd Battalion, the Rifles, or the 82nd Airborne Division to an Afghan unit isn't a serious strategy. No one serious believes in it anymore. But somehow, as happened in Vietnam, as happened through human history, it's somehow easier to muddle along, sort of pretending that it's working, and then leave in a year or two, rather than leave at once. The real crime is not that. The real crime is that no serious attempt has been made by the United States to devise and deliver a political solution to what is really a political problem. The problem of Afghanistan is not military, and it won't be solved by military means. The insurgency is a symptom of a deeper disease, the lack of a political settlement within Afghanistan and a political settlement across the region between Afghanistan's neighbours and near neighbours. And that is not going to be solved, although some of the symptoms may be suppressed, by a so-called strategy of garrisoning selected parts of the country.
I mean, is this another problem that people are all very good at talking about strategy and looking to the future, but once again, certainly in this region, in Afghanistan in particular, there's a clear, what appears to be an almost willful misunderstanding of several centuries of history, several centuries of failed occupation by a number of different states. Does it concern you that people seem almost reticent about looking to their past to try and make better plans for the future?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point, Tom, and it's a point made by Barbara Tuchman in her book The March of Folly. I mean, she looks at how Britain lost its colonies in North America, at the Vietnam War, at the way the Renaissance popes managed to alienate so many of their such large parts of the church. In each case, anyone sitting back and thinking rationally wouldn't have carried on behaving in the way they were doing. We would have not carried on trying to impose taxes on the colonists of North America, still less tried to solve the problem by sending a small army or two small armies to sort of rampage around North America. But there was this willful refusal to look the facts in the face, whether it's the facts of the past or the facts of the present situation. And very often, and perhaps especially in foreign policy, it's because emotion, sentiment, unreason triumph over reason.
Let's look at that issue then of, you know, who are the people that can stand up to ministers and say, you know, we don't think what you're doing here is right, and that's the diplomats. Now, as you mentioned in your book, there are only two senior people within the Foreign Office, Elizabeth Wilmhurst and Karl Ross, who resigned over the Iraq War, something which you felt, or you say in the book, you felt that more people should have done, or there should have been more people standing up. Do you worry that there is in not enough of a culture within the Foreign Office of diplomats who really know what they're doing, saying to ministers, this is wrong and we can't go on like this?
Yes, I do, and it's one of the conclusions of my book. I can think of several senior officials in the Foreign Office who are the sort of policy equivalent of the butler in Remains of the Day. They serve up more or less whatever their master wants. They don't disagree with them. I was told as ambassador in Afghanistan not to report things which might upset our own defence ministry, because the Foreign Office needed a good relationship with the MOD, and that was more important than the wider national interest. I think most officials, almost by definition, are not particularly brave. I mean, the head of our Middle East department at the time of the Iraq War, he said to me he knew it was wrong invading Iraq. He knew we didn't have to go in then. The policy of containment was working, the inspections hadn't played out. But he said, I couldn't resign. I'd got children at school. I was getting boarding school allowance from the Foreign Office. I decided to go along with what ministers had decided. And I sympathise with him. I can understand that. But, you know, there are times, and particularly in matters of peace and war, you know, this isn't deciding the route of a new bypass or deciding whether to close libraries in Camden or whatever it may be. It's a matter of life and death. And, you know, some of the MPs who rage so much about our membership of the European Union might remember that they have been supporting a war in Afghanistan that is costing us each year more than Britain pays in our subscription to the European Union. And we derive tens of billions of pounds worth of benefits from our membership of the European Union. I find it very difficult to point to any benefits the country as a whole has derived from our war in Afghanistan.
I mean, that's kind of a pessimistic note, I guess, to strike. I just wonder, does your concern then extend looking towards the future? When you consider there are politicians who, as you say, seem sometimes to find it very difficult to engage with these facts on the ground, there are some, you know, career civil servants who, as you said, face what's actually a fairly sort of mundane decision that they make about something that's very important. Do you sometimes think, oh, this isn't the sort of the calling that I had? This wasn't my experience of it. Do you worry about where the discipline of diplomacy is going?
No, because I think the things I'm saying are not particular to diplomacy or the Foreign Office or ministers. I mean, they're part of human nature. You see it, I see it in industry, in commerce, in any organisation. It takes a lot of courage for people lower down the organisation to disagree with those at the top, even when they know that those at the top are doing the wrong thing. The difference is with civil servants, it's like your doctor or your lawyer. They are being paid by the taxpayer to offer ministers objective advice. And I'm afraid sometimes, and I point to three occasions in my book where they failed to do so, they decide that it's somehow easier to serve up what ministers want rather than the realities which should be obvious to any objective analyst of the situation.
Cheryl Cooper-Coles, thank you very much indeed. The book is Ever the Diplomat. It's out now. Thank you very much for coming and joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
We're going to have some music now from former Concrete's vocalist Victoria Bergsman. This is Taken by Trees with Watch the Waves.
That was Victoria Bergsman with Watch the Waves. I rather like that, Tom. What do you think?
That was a perfect accompaniment to a gentle Sunday.
Really?
Yeah, lovely stuff.
Good. There we are. Tom Edwards says it's perfect. Lovely stuff. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back after this.
When Sydney opera singer Adrian Tamburini isn't wowing audiences in his city's iconic opera house, he's outside enjoying its gorgeous surf beaches and magnificent harbour.
We have some incredible nature. Sydney, for example, is built around the water. There is water everywhere. There is sunshine. An outdoor kind of lifestyle is really important to us here in Sydney. And that reflects in the way we approach life.
There's nothing like Australia. To keep up to date on the latest issue of Monocle, new films on our website, products in our shops, and new programmes on Monocle 24, sign up for our free weekly bulletin. We'll tell you about special Monocle events and make sure you're ahead of the curve with all the happenings at Midori House. Just go to monocle.com to subscribe. Let's stay in touch.
The civil war in Sri Lanka was one of the bloodiest conflicts of the last 20 years, ending in 2009 with the government claiming victory over the Tamil Tiger rebels. But that victory came at a huge cost. A UN investigation has found that up to 40,000 civilians could have been murdered in the final 5 months of the conflict. The Sri Lankan government refuses to accept those findings. Indeed, their strategy to defeat the Tigers has now been studied by other regimes dealing with internal uprisings.
Francis Harrison covered Sri Lanka for 4 years for the BBC and is one of the few Western correspondents to report extensively from the war zone. In her new book, Still Counting the Dead, Harrison has collected first-hand accounts of the atrocities, and she joins us in the studio now to explain why Sri Lanka should still be somewhat higher up the news agenda than it is right now. Francis, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you very much.
Before we get into the story of what happened in those final few months. You're in Sri Lanka for several years. As a journalist, how difficult was it to cover a conflict like this, both in terms of its complexities and also just logistically?
For a large part of the war, journalists were not allowed anywhere near the areas controlled by the Tamil Tiger rebels who the army were fighting against. So for the first year that I lived in Sri Lanka, I never met a Tamil Tiger rebel. You know, I met them in London and other places. I simply didn't meet them in Sri Lanka. Then I was very lucky the time that I was in Sri Lanka that it was during a peace process attempt and the area, the country opened up. And so I gained a lot of access to the war zone, basically, and met the Tigers at quite a senior level and maintained those contacts over the years. And then the period I've written about in the book, it was a period where the Sri Lankan government deliberately denied access not only to journalists, but also to aid workers, so as to ensure that there were no independent witnesses to what happened in the final bloodbath, if you like, the final endgame of the civil war in 2009.
And let's talk about 2009, as you call it, this final bloodbath. It was a very much a scorched earth policy, wasn't it, from the Sri Lankan government, of this was the way they were finally going to deal with the issue.
Yes, they very much assumed that the ends justified the means, and they didn't discriminate between civilians and combatants. Yes, it was scorched earth. And I think what was really shocking for me when I started to research this, I'd obviously watched it long distance from London and talked to one of the senior rebels during the course of the war. But what I hadn't really understood properly, and still find quite difficult to come to terms with and to understand, was that there was a lot of deliberate targeting of civilian food queues, civilian concentrations of population, and even of hospitals. And that was something that I think when I initially came to research the book, I thought when I'd heard about hospitals being hit by government shells, that it was a degree of carelessness or it was accidental, it was not being too careful about where you fired it. But it became apparent when I talked to many of the people who were in those hospitals and doctors and medics that it was deliberate, and it was really shocking to come to terms with that.
It's interesting because there's certain degrees of pragmatism from both sides. Like you mentioned in the book that, for example, tourist traffic, you know, the tourist trade was, they tried to sort of leave that alone, both sides. There was a sort of a pragmatism about the value that had for the country and the jeopardy that would put on the finances. And yet in other ways, as you say, in terms of these kind of targeting of hospitals, things like that, it's so sort of hostile. It's simply about causing the maximum sort of amount of human damage. It's quite hard to square those two, isn't it? The pragmatism on one hand and this such a kind of hostile approach on the other.
Well, I think, I mean, you have to remember that the island was quite divided. So what happened in the south and especially in the capital, you know, it seemed miles and miles away, a different world from what happened in the areas where the war actually took place. I mean, you probably were, you know, an hour's flight or a few hours drive, and yet it was completely different world. I mean, in Colombo, you had, you know, skyscrapers and shopping centres and tourists and quite a lot of wealth comparatively, whereas in the war zone, you know, you had children who'd never seen a skyscraper, never been on a train, never seen a laptop computer or a telephone, really. So the world, they were worlds apart. I think when it comes to things like not targeting tourists, then it was really pragmatic on the part of the Tigers because they knew they'd lose huge international support. I mean, not that they had much support by the end, but that they would, you know, go down even further in the estimation of the international community, and they needed that international community to try and help them. So it was pragmatic, but I don't think there was any real contradiction between the brutality of the war and the awareness that they needed to woo the outside world for their causes.
When we come to those final few months, a lot of the deaths occurred in quite a thin strip of land right on the north coast. Talk us through how that happened.
Well, you had somewhere around 400,000 Tamils concentrated in what were rebel areas, and of course the rebels did not allow them out of their territory, which was, you know, a very serious problem. Those people were basically shelled and pushed towards the coast. They weren't allowed out by the Tigers. The government basically attacked those areas, so they moved towards the sea. And by the end, you had probably, well, 100,000, 150,000. The figures are very difficult to come by, accurate figures. But you had a very sizable concentration of quite desperate, hungry women, children, men, elderly people on this tiny coastal spit of land of just basically sand and scrub jungle, and places that really weren't properly habitable in the height of the summer in May, you know, very hot temperatures. And the sand meant they couldn't dig down in and actually create trenches or bunkers in which to hide. So they had to cut up their saris and make sandbags and hide behind them. And obviously, you know, no sanitation, very few solid buildings. So, you know, that people have drawn a lot of comparisons between what happened in Sri Lanka to civilians and what is now happening in Syria. But at least in Syria, horrific as it is, there are actually structures, proper buildings, but there were very few of those left by the time we got to April, May 2009 in Sri Lanka. People were sheltering, camping in flimsy tents, and yet being hit by multi-barreled rocket launchers and kefir jets, supersonic jets, and with very little protection at all. So a shocking, you know, experience for those who survived.
I just wonder about bringing this kind of story then onto the page. It's obviously such a difficult task. You're covering, you know, truly horrific, you know, events, terrible suffering. I mean, what is the sort of challenge of delivering that? Obviously, you want to confront people with the reality. You need to educate, in some cases, people as to what actually went on. What are the specific challenges of actually bringing that through, and how much did how you chose to structure the book help you to do that?
Well, initially, I thought I would tell a long chronology, a story of 6 months of missing history, if you like, this black hole that where nobody really knew quite what happened and what it was like. And I thought, OK, I'll do, you know, January the 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and go through it like that. And then I realised that actually, if you're on the receiving end of bombardment, you don't remember the date of everything that happened to you. And one day of bombing can be much like another, in a sense. And it's quite repetitive, and often sitting in a trench is very boring, too. And it wasn't really that this happened on this day and this attack on the next day that was interesting about the war. It was how the individual characters went through that experience, the fact that they were relatively happy before it really intensified, the fact that they went through these awful, searing experiences and somehow found the courage to carry on, and then, you know, at the end all escaped and managed to get abroad, and how they look back on it now, how they reflected on the impact on their lives and their political ideas, that I felt was the story and the interesting thing. It was how the individual experiences war rather than a series of dates and attacks. And so that's why in the end I told the story through about 10 different characters who I felt kind of represented different issues. So there was a mother, a teacher, a nun, a shopkeeper. There were a whole range of different kinds of characters, and each story was quite different, and yet in a way I think they reinforced the same pattern of experience.
There's been, as we mentioned, a UN investigation into what happened in Sri Lanka. The report has come out, but nothing has then really happened after that. The Sri Lankan government is still, they still has lots of allies across the world. They're still pushing tourism. I'm sure their tourism minister is going to be here next week for the World Travel Market, telling us we all should go to Sri Lanka. Do you worry that this story hasn't really got out as much as it should, and that the reputation of the Sri Lankan government hasn't really been affected?
Yes, I do worry. I worry that this is one of the worst atrocities against civilians this century. You're talking about, according to the UN, 40,000 civilians killed in 5 months. And one of the authors of that report recently said it could be 75,000. So you're talking about more people than even in Syria, and in a much shorter time space. And that people don't even really know that it even happened. I mean, I find that extraordinary in this day and age of, you know, satellite phones and social media and technology, that you can have a kind of a black hole, literally. I mean, something that people don't know about. And they still travel to Sri Lanka and don't familiarise themselves with the history of the country, the recent history. And the fact that, yes, the fighting's finished, the guns are silent, but many of the underlying root causes of the conflict are still there, unaddressed completely. And I think, you know, in the aftermath of the war, many people who knew the country well hoped that the Sri Lankan government would seize this window of opportunity and try and make peace with minority Tamils and, you know, people who dissented from their political points of view. And it was an opportunity, and they've missed it completely, unfortunately. And so this, you know, will eventually, I think, come back to bite them.
Just on that point, I mean, the book obviously tells these very moving human stories. And one of the real sad elements, I guess, enduring elements of it, is how fragmented these communities, these people are. They're displaced, they're all over the world. Do you think there is this kind of problem that the human story is one of enduring sadness that really hasn't been addressed at all?
I think they're fragmented because a lot of Tamils now don't trust each other. And that's in a way where an outsider had to come and tell the story. They couldn't do it themselves because they're too traumatised. They don't know who to trust. And also they're very, very fearful still. And we're talking nearly 4 years on. They can't come out in public and say what happened to them. And they went through these horrific experiences that, you know, for me, it was almost like interviewing Holocaust survivors, some of the things these people went through and how messed up they are now. And the fact they can't come and say that in England is quite shocking, that they're still so fearful. But I have to say, although, you know, the story are grim and the things they went through are dreadful, there are also really redeeming features about these experiences, that people are very courageous and really surprisingly so under pressure. I mean, yes, there was a lot of disgraceful behaviour and betrayal and awful things that went on, but there were individuals who showed extraordinary bravery and strength. And, you know, gave things to when they had nothing, when they were absolutely at the bottom, they found the strength to give to other people, to share their last meals or to risk their lives, literally, to save a stranger. So there are really redeeming human features from these stories as well.
Frances Harrison, thank you very much indeed for coming in. The book is Still Counting the Dead. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Our final guest is a journalist and writer who found fame back in the early 90s hosting youth entertainment shows. Youth entertainment shows, do we call them those? We can, can't we?
It sounds a bit like we're 80 years old.
It does, but don't worry. Youth entertainment shows, we're going to stick with that, for networks such as MTV and also Bravo TV in Germany.
But the excitement of partying with your idols can only last so long, and Christiana Becker's career took an unusual turn when she chose to embrace Islam in the mid-1990s. Her new book, From MTV to Mecca, tells the story of that journey and looks at the relationship of faith and modern society. Christiana, a very warm welcome to The Monocle Weekly. I wanted to start by going back to those sort of early days at MTV, the halcyon days of that station, I suppose. What was it like working there? Was it a difficult environment, or was it a place where you were really able to kind of flourish and grow as a broadcaster?
I wouldn't say neither. It was it was absolutely amazing. You know, we were all young and came from all over Europe, all over the world, in fact, and just had a blast working in music, interviewing bands, meeting bands, you know, being creative. We had small production budgets, so we needed to be inventive and creative. And it was great fun, really. At night I went out and the next day I told Europe what was happening in the clubs of London, you know, bumping into George Michael and so on and so forth. So, no, it was great fun at the time, but it, you know, after a while, it was just music, and out at night as well, because everybody loves music. So when they ask you, so what do you do? Well, I'm a presenter on MTV. Oh, really? And bands, music, and videos, you know, once again, the conversation. So it did my head in a bit after a while.
I just wonder, what kind of pressure does that exert on you? Obviously, there's the sort of physical and emotional draining experience of, you know, partying every day, and it's quite a
working
high
every day
octane environment.
Yeah.
But did it put you under pressure of a different type? And was that one of the things that prompted you to look to move beyond that and into something else? Did you feel that it, your sort of life lacked something working in that environment?
Yes, I always felt that, even before I worked on MTV, that something was lacking. And I just couldn't put my finger on it, what it was. Something was always missing inside. There was some kind of dissatisfaction there, you know. And, there was a lot of pressure, you know. You always had to perform, always had to be perfect, one show chasing the next, presenting in front of 70,000 people, you know, sort of with no notice, no time to prepare, you know. It was a high octane life, and certainly it couldn't be endured forever, you know, really not.
Let's talk about your conversion to Islam, because as you said, you were, you know, you're going out every night, your whole life was surrounded by music, and yet you felt there wasn't quite something there. What was it that prompted you to look at Islam?
I met Imran Khan at a dinner party. And
the Pakistani cricketer.
Pakistani politician.
Well, now a politician, yes.
Who was a cricketer who had just won the World Cup for Pakistan at the time. So he was just, he became a first Islam teacher. You know, he introduced me to Islam. I wasn't looking for it. I know I had an unhappiness inside, but, and he suddenly, you know, introduced me to Islam. Talked to me about these very different values. He had a very different approach, you know, different values, values fueled by faith, you know, and it was challenging. For example, the first time we went out, I turned up in an Alaya mini dress, and he asked me to keep on my coat all night and explained the concept of modesty. You know, here I was in the entertainment industry, if you've got it, flaunt it. And he said, look, in our culture, in our religion, women don't show flesh, and men also dress modestly. Women and men dress modestly. And we had a lot of debates just about this issue, about every issue.
I just wonder then, how much of a sort of clash of cultures did you find that was? How much of a challenge? Because a number of people who've been through, I remember, it reminds me of some things that, for example, someone like Cat Stevens talked very similarly about the demands that were being made on him.
Was he wearing mini-dress?
Through the 70s. slightly different.
Possibly.
He actually looked good in a mini-dress.
He did
well.
Look good. But, and then as he, once he had sort of embraced Islam, he found it was an incredible relief from a lot of these pressures that he felt. Did you always find it was very welcoming in that way? Or did you find it was something that occasionally was something of a confrontation between you know, that your life before and your life after?
Well, I mean, both. One, it was very much a process that took time, you know, to surrender to the will of God and not to any trends or fashions. I still try to be fashionable, but I now cover, you know, wear, I mean, longish clothes and giving up drinking or taking smoking dope or whatever, you know, whatever it was. It was a process and it took time. I had to almost fight for my right to drink water at parties, you know. I mean, first Ramadan was a disaster because I had gone out the night before and had a few glasses of champagne, and then the next morning I lay in bed with a pounding headache, dehydrated, and I gave up. You know, this is not for me. But then the next year I had given up alcohol and basically flying through it, you know, and ever since, even though they're getting really long, these fasts now. And at the same time, it is such a liberation, I can tell you now, you know. And, you know, even when people let me down or contracts let you down, whatever challenges happen in life, I know God is always there. People make mistakes and so on, but, you know, I know I have my faith. And so that inner vacuum that I always had is now filled.
Do you find that there's a bit of a clash between youth culture now and Islam? Do you think there's a way that the two can live side by side?
You know, I am actually developing a TV program about contemporary Muslim culture, because there are a lot of young people who are cutting edge designers, musicians, you know, artists, and they express themselves, but in a halal way, you know, kosher way, whatever, you know, in a way that is not against the concepts of faith. Of course, you can be young and creative and everything, you know, and not drink. I mean, what you see out there, this kind of youth culture, everybody getting laid and getting smashed, and yeah, there is a clash between that and a life of faith, any kind of faith. But, you know, that's not what it means to be, what has to be part of being young. Same as when people ask me, is there a clash between Islamic values and European values? It doesn't mean being a European that you have to eat pork and that you have to, you know, drink a lot of beer. No, you can be European, meaning reliable, responsible, you believe in democracy and environmental protection and, you know, equal justice. These are all Islamic values too.
Christiana Backett, thank you very much indeed. The book is called From MTV to Mecca, and I must say, probably the only book ever to have quotes on the back praising it from both Jim Kerr from Simple Minds and Tariq Ramadan, Professor of Islamic Studies at Oxford University.
Bob Geldof and Imran Khan as well.
Exactly. And don't forget Syed Hussein Nazar, Professor of Islamic Studies at George Washington University. Well done on getting all five of them to praise the book. Thank you very much indeed, Christiana Backett. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. Well, that wasn't too bad, was it?
I thought that show was bordered on sensational. I'm a modest man.
Bordered on sensational.
It was on the cusp.
Do you feel it was my contributions which sort of meant it didn't quite get over the cusp?
I didn't want to be explicit about that, Steve, but now you've brought it up. We can talk about this afterwards.
We can indeed. I was a very big fan of Sherrod Cooper-Coles, and I did like the fact that a man who in his own book describes himself as a posh toff in a sort of ironic sense, but still, and is sort of obviously a slightly older gentleman and a knight of the realm as well, the first thing he says to me is, "You're old-fashioned, Steve."
That's because you're wearing your your bow tie and your tweed jacket, Steve. I've told you before about dressing
that
like that.
That look is in. It's in, I tell you. Yeah, no, I rather liked him. He was really good. We're going to get him. I think we're going to try and get him involved in on the magazine side. I'm going to get him to write a couple of things for us.
A very, very knowledgeable man.
Yes, he knows his stuff. Yeah. He knows his stuff.
That's very impressive.
As do and did all of our guests, and as do and did you, Tom Edwards.
Oh, you're very sweet, Steve.
There we are. Yeah. And that is all we have time for on this edition, 174th edition of The Monocle Weekly. Don't forget, all our shows can be downloaded from iTunes, monocle.com. It says here I should mention The Urbanist, but I'm not going to mention that. The show was produced by Tom Hall. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. The studio manager was Jack Phillips. The Weekly will be back at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards. Goodbye.
Goodbye.